Welcome, everyone. As you know, we're going to be continuing our series based upon my newest book, The Three Principles of Oneness. Tonight, we're going to go over the next chapter. And this chapter is, I have entitled this talk in this chapter as The Cosmogenesis of Oneness, How We Got Here and Why It Matters. So I'm going to start, as I always do, with a reading. And tonight's reading is by a very special individual who goes by the name, or went by the name, Pierre Teilhard de Chardin. De Chardin was a Jesuit Catholic priest who was a seminal figure in the middle 20th century, and in many ways an inspiration to me, and also someone I consider a constant companion as I work at helping folks to integrate the two worlds of how things work and why they matter. So I'm going to start with a quote that's in my book from Father Taylor. Is evolution a theory, a system, or an hypothesis? It is much more. It is a general condition to which all theories, all hypotheses, all systems must bow, and which they must satisfy henceward if they are to be thinkable and true. This quote illustrates one of the main teachings that we find in science, one that has evolved over the last 100 years or so. And that is the theory of evolution. Now, evolution as a theory has been around a very, very long time. And in fact, there are antecedents to the idea of evolution in Buddhist writings that go back thousands of years. But it became something fundamental to science after the work of folks like Charles Darwin. And now today, with our ability to study the very small world as well as the very big world, we find that everything in our universe seems to function out of this theory or principle we call evolution. If there was any doubt left for anyone about this, simply have to talk to microbiologists about the way that viruses and things of that nature evolve and adapt. But there's something important about that theory, particularly for those who follow the path of oneness in the legacy of the Buddha. And that is, we have our own genesis story, which one might call the cosmogenesis. Now, we take this story not from ancient texts, but we take it from our current understanding of how things work. And so what we know, and that's what the first passage is in this chapter, is talking about something very specific. And that is talking about what I call unconscious oneness. So what is unconscious oneness? Well, in the vision that I have, which is informed both by science, how things work, and the Buddhist path, why things matter, I see life unfolding as a series of evolutions. The first period of this evolution seems to be elements coming together. So if we go back 13, 14 billion years ago to the beginning of our known universe, we find that there were very few elements present. But out of these elements came matter. And eventually out of those elements came organic life. And I can only really speak about Earth because unfortunately I don't live yet in the age of Star Trek, so I can't talk about any other alien species, although I personally believe they're out there. And if those photos or films that the Pentagon released are any truth to them, that they may be alien craft and not some kind of sophisticated drone, I sure hope they're Vulcans and not Klingons for first contact. But we have this grand drama, the grand drama of our universe, where we start with these invisible elements like hydrogen and helium, and then we give forth that there's at this point of singularity, which we call the Big Bang. Everything that exists, its energy, its source was there 14 billion years ago. And it bursts forth rapidly. And in some ways we understand, in some ways we don't fully yet grasp. But here we are. And that next stage that came on the Earth was that of organic life. And so even with a single-celled creature, there was a type of consciousness. And that type of consciousness became greater as those life forms became more complex. In fact, I would say this, and this is something that you can sort of use as an aphorism, that complexity leads to consciousness. If there's something that's clear about the nature of our universe that we can observe, is that it is incredibly creative. It is incredibly creative, and with complexity of organisms comes consciousness. And this consciousness, however, is in a very limited or primitive form. Self-awareness is very limited. And you might say that within this unconscious oneness, organisms, life forms, live out of a natural sort of hierarchy. Insects and some birds seem to function like a hive, like a group. But as they become more complex, you see these natural hierarchies start to form. And each creature has its place. Each creature has its unfolding of its life that all seems to make sense, from the very beautiful to the very bizarre. And we are a part of that because that is where we came from. So part of understanding how we got here is that we're a part of all of this. Everything in me, my atomic structure, began out there in the stars. And all of my life, everything on Earth is related to me genetically. And during that period that the Aboriginals, which are the oldest living primitive group still here, still with us, among us. They called it the dream time. It was the time when we were still in that unconscious oneness, where we were part of those natural hierarchies, and we knew nothing more. But somehow, miraculously, in the complexity of our evolution, some saying, as far back as 2 million years ago, and then as recent as 250,000 years ago, for folks like us, that those hominids arose, that our ancestors arose, and there were many. There wasn't just one type of human. There were many. Some of them living together at the same time. And we are the descendants of this evolution. But somewhere along that line, as the Aboriginals say, we left the dream time. We were no longer like the animals. We were now self-aware. On those great savannas, we were the creature that stood up above the brush and grass and looked out at the horizon, and we began to wonder. And this form of self-consciousness allowed us to develop our brains and our bodies, to move way beyond the predictable patterns that we came from. And this self-conscious awareness was also the birth of our existential unhappiness. Because unlike the creatures that we were once a part of, we were now separate from them. Unlike the natural hierarchies or the natural ways within which we fit into the group, now a new type of struggle emerged. One that was strange, and one in which we had to then try to figure out how to maneuver this strange world that we found ourselves in. The unconscious oneness, still there is an aching and a yearning, and it comes up in our myths. We want to return to a paradise. We want to go back to the womb. We want to return to that place of unconscious oneness. Freud criticized it as the oceanic feeling. And it is a very primitive form and a primitive desire. But there's also something else that calls us out. And this calling out is where how things work and why they matter comes together. At least for those of us that follow the path of oneness and the legacy of the Buddha. And I think that the Buddha was unique. Historians believe so. And what did the Buddha discover? He discovered by his own experiment that not only were we not to desire just to return to some unconscious oneness, and in fact that sort of desire is one that would lead us to create all kinds of fantasies and ideas and deities writ like humans, full of jealousy and passion, beings that might be very powerful, but yet we're not much different from us. He asked us to move beyond that and move within. He was a holy diver. He dived deep into the depths of what it means to be a human being. And within those depths, he found his true self. And when he looked at that star, his gaze cast above the horizon, and he saw Venus, he realized that this terrestrial boundary that his consciousness had been caught up in was now transcendent. Not a transcendence that would leave that world behind, but one that would transform that world and yet no longer be bound by those tribal identities, no longer be bound by those boundaries of caste and class, or the color of one's skin, or one's culture. That a new way of being was discovered. A new way of experiencing a conscious oneness. One that would allow us to grow and mature. And in some ways, his was a messianic vision, a messianic mission that he felt that he needed to call people to wake up to their true self. wake up and become everything that they can possibly be. And even more so, that we would not do this as a solitary act, but rather we would see our own awakening as contingent and continuous with everyone else. And that somehow we would lift humanity up out of just living out of an instinctive drive. That we would be lifted up through the discovery of the pliability of our brains into a universal consciousness, a oneness consciousness, where we might live fully beyond all of the conditioned survivalist stagnancy, and that we might find ourselves emerging into a life lived fully. And that we might learn to love freely beyond the boundaries of, oh, I should love you because of what you do for me. Or I can't love you because of what they say you are. Now, the Buddha's message of liberation, the Dharma, was a call for us to move into a new consciousness. We moved from the evolution of matter to the evolution of organic life into the evolution of a consciousness. A consciousness, a dimension and sphere that we call Buddha. And that living in this way, we could move beyond those survivalist instincts which dictated our existence like robotic slaves, but that we could move into a freedom of expression where our own very life was our art, and that we could learn to give fully and completely without ever worrying that we would run out of resources, without ever worrying that it was too much. That we would find within ourselves a deep well, a deep source that all of us can dive into as holy divers. And bring forth that elixir of immortality, that elixir of a life boundless. And out of these natural hierarchies we once lived in, we would now have to create new relations. And that we would now learn how to live in right relation with each other. We would learn the three principles. We would learn that the easiest way for all of us to recognize our interdependence, our oneness, is through suffering. Suffering that we all have experienced. Suffering born of separation. And that we could learn to be like the universe. Bruce Lee used to say, be like water, my friend. And I agree with that, but I'm going to add to it a little bit. Be like the universe. The universe is always creative. Every time something changes, the universe brings something new into being. And you might even say that without change, nothing new can come into being. And sometimes that change is one that we do not want to let go. But if we hold on to it, or we try to hold on to it, what we find is that it is already gone. It is no longer alive. Finally, that our true identity, our true self, is the universe. We are the universe speaking, thinking, communicating, crying, laughing, dancing. So the second chapter is really about how things came to be, our cosmogenesis, and why it matters. There's a difference, however, in how I might view evolution than someone else. For me, evolution as a theory, and in science, a theory is just the establishment of a teaching or doctrine that fits most of the evidence that we have, that we can observe and that we can test. But I believe in an anthropomorphic universe. Now, when I say anthropomorphic, I'm not limiting it to humans. And maybe that's not even the right term anymore. Maybe I believe in a sentient universe. I believe that evolution, even within its random beauty, has a purpose. And that purpose is to bring forth sentiency. And that sentiency is to bring forth a greater oneness. And at some point with an incredible and fantastic merger of everything that we think is material and the things that we define as immaterial, that they will become one. In Teilhard de Chardin's theology, he called it the omega point. John Wheeler, the physicist, called it the ultimate expression of retroactive causality. Me, I just call it Buddha. As we recognize on Saturday with our beautiful Hanumat Suri service, where we baptize the egg in the sweet teas. It reminds me of the fact that the hydrangea plant, which has been here for millions, tens of millions of years, when you first steep it and you first begin to try to use it as a tea, it's very bitter. But as it ferments, it becomes very sweet. And that's how I look at our journey. That we start out very bitter, a very bitter background. But we evolve, and we enlighten, and we emerge into that sweet and true country.